Thank you very much for the invitation to come and speak to you this evening. I trust you like lamb because I think I'm the sacrificial one. I've just had an hour in it felt like a padded room just down the corridor there, being given some warning or gentle understanding of some of your concerns. So I look forward to having a chat, and that's really one of the reasons why I wanted to accept this invitation, because there's no point being an organisation, in this case The Age, prepared to dish out criticism and yet not turn up to your own community and take it in turn. So it's in that spirit that it was a pleasure for mine to come and accept your invitation. Can I start formally by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet this evening, and I'd like to pay my respects to their elders past and present. My subject this evening is news and what makes news, and I thought I would provide you with a little bit of a personal insight that comes out of that CV, although you've gone a long way back. I hadn't expected you to mention mum and dad, and for those who are lovers of classical music, it's one of the, particularly of my oldest brother, one of his great claims to fame is that the first night he ever spent in the Windsor Hotel was being babysat by Hepzibah Menuhin, because my father was leading the orchestra when Yehudi was out here playing with the Melbourne Symphony. So not a bad little claim to fame if you're if lovers of classical music. But to give you an idea of my mindset, I'll go back just over 5 years to Christchurch in early September of 2010. I moved across there at the start of 2000. And at that stage in 2010, I had a little boy, Rafferty, with my wife. He was born 4 hours before I turned 50, so that'll give you an idea of how stupid I can be in terms of life decisions. But anyway, this particular time, when Rafferty was 6 weeks old, he was sleeping in a little side room to our main bedroom, and it was about just on 4:30 in the morning, and I could hear him squawking. So I was halfway out of bed to go and collect him and bring him back to his mum when the 7.1 earthquake hit the province of Canterbury, some distance from Christchurch, and thankfully very deap. And the two of us leapt out of our bed. We grabbed Raffy out of the cot, and we stood in the door jamb together as the whole house buckled and rocked and rolled, as you do in an earthquake of that significance. And what I was doing was looking out into the main hall where we had a wood burner, and my greatest concern was that the front of the wood burner was going to burst open and spill hot coals onto the floor. It was a little odd weatherboard in Christchurch, and set the house alight. So after about 30 seconds of this earthquake, and it lasted for about 45 seconds, when it was pretty evident that the house was not going to fall down and that we were going to survive, I turned to my wife. I didn't have to turn very far because she was right there. I was hugging her so tightly, and I said to her, "What a great story." I couldn't help myself. We're going to survive, and the journalist instinct kicks in, and I couldn't wait to get out to find out what had happened. She, of course, is sitting there going, "Where the hell do you think you're going? We've got a six-week-old child, and you know, you need to get and clean up the glasses that are broken and look after us." And so we did a bit of a pact that I would hang around until dawn and she could get a friend over, and then I was going to go and chase that story. So I do have an unusual mindset. Of course, you know, that story was significant enough, although thankfully very little damage to the town and nobody was killed. But not that much later, in February of the following year, and we're only a couple of weeks away from the fifth anniversary of that earthquake, of course the nasty one hit, which killed 185 people. So it fundamentally changed the nature of earthquakes, and I learned very quickly at that point the extraordinary power of the earth and how brutal it can be. But it sort of becomes, I think, one of the truisms of journalism is that the only people who run towards a disaster and not away from it are, of course, our emergency service personnel, the firemen, the police, the medical personnel, but also the journalists. We run towards disasters because that's one of the fundamentals of our craft. In fact, you could argue the first and arguably the most important thing that we should worry about, and that's to bear witness on behalf of a community, to be there to see what is occurring and report as best we can, regardless of how limited our perspective may be where we stand on that ground. but to tell our community and tell the world exactly what has happened to us. And that was what really drove our newsroom after the big earthquake. And the reason why we put out a paper the next day is that we just wanted to tell our community what had happened to it. And interestingly, for all that we talk about modern media and how everybody's on smartphones and that's where you get your news, with over half of the city of Christchurch without power that day, with no power you have no television, your laptop battery very quickly runs out, which wipes out your internet. You can't recharge your mobile phone. In fact, you find out very quickly that you're completely divorced from the world. And the virtue of us putting out that supposedly dying medium, the newspaper, the next morning onto the streets and the gardens of so many people across Christchurch was enormously powerful for them and a great connection for them, because for many people that was the first time they actually knew what had happened in their city, and it told them that story. They're the easy ones, though. That sort of news is a very simple thing to do. Big breaking news, big disaster, car crash on the freeway, anything of that nature where there is a disaster is pretty simple, and there's no real difficult news judgment to decide that that's what you want to chase. And I know there's a lot of commentary and criticism of the media, and justifiably so, that we concentrate on the negative. That's all we seem to cover, that the papers are filled with disaster and criticism and debate, and the, you know, politics is all about that. It's never about policy. It's always about the conflict of personality. And why do you do this? Why is the media fundamentally biased towards the negative and the disaster? One of the reasons is because we know it sells. Bad news sells. We are a business. We are a commercial business. And our job is to capture attention and make sure that people keep coming back to the newspaper. And over hundreds of years of publishing newspapers, all publishers and all editors know that the bad news story is the one that will capture people's attention. Hundreds of thousands of people will drive up and down the Monash Freeway every day, and none of them ever make it into a newspaper or onto the television news. But the crash, the bus that crashes, or the car that flips, as I think one of them did this morning, that is news, because that's the rarity, that's the odd bit that changes the circumstance of a normal day. And I'm thankful to Ross Gittins, and I'll make Ross a plug. Ross is the economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. He's been covering economics and federal politics for many years. He's put out a book late last year on his career as a journalist. And in that, he reflects on that nature of bad news and why is it bad news. And he's dug into the psychology of it, and what he points out so beautifully is the thing that the psychologists call the surveillance function. That it's innately within all of us to constantly be looking out for what is safe and what is not safe. If you like, as animals, as a species looking for survival, how do I know that that road is a safe road to travel down as opposed to another one? And should I be going down it? And it's because of that. It's because of our deep subconscious looking to know that things are going to be safe, that we want to know where things are not safe. We want to know about the disaster. We want to know about the person who's done something stupid or who might constitute a threat to us. And so it's not only that sense of the journalist feeding what we know from a commercial sense will allow us to sell newspapers, but it's a human element too that says, I'm constantly surveying the world, and one of the key things I want to know from you is, where does danger lie? And if you can tell me where danger lies, I can react accordingly and try and avoid it. The stories that I find particularly interesting, though, are those that have very little of that element. How do we bring a deep, unsolvable social issue to the attention of people and get them interested in that story? Homelessness, for example, has been with us for the nature of the history of mankind, and it's a significant issue in this city. But it's not something that you would generally put on the front page. It's not something that will capture a lot of attention and grab people's empathy and make them want to engage with that particular story. In January of 2014, 2 years ago, an Age reporter interviewed a gentleman called Wayne Perry about the dangers of being homeless. Tragically, just a few days later, Mouse, as he was known to all his friends, was stabbed by a mentally ill young man and murdered. Because the Age, purely coincidentally, had that very recent interview with Mouse about the dangers of living on the street, we were able to turn a story that would have rated no more than a couple of paragraphs at the back of the paper into a front page story and bring a focus upon what it meant to be homeless in our city. As a consequence of that story, it triggered a lot of changes by the Melbourne City Council in terms of the support they provided for the homeless. And it also gave the newsroom the courage to go look back at that particular story and start looking for other examples of homelessness that the community might be interested in and might be able to respond to. And so in the middle of the last year, many of you may recall a fantastic front page story we had about a 19-year-old girl living with a boyfriend in a tent under an inner city overpass, studying for her VCE, with a suit carrier hanging up from the underpass that she would change into every day, and she'd go off and try and study for, you know, see if she could pass that. That triggered an extraordinary response. Within a very short time, she was offered financial support, she had a free apartment to live in, and she had a guarantee from her university that if she passed her VCE, she would have a course, regardless of what her score was, that they would help her on the next path. So again, we find the ability to take a story that most of us will find difficult to engage with, but through the power of that human example, actually make it matter to people and draw them into it and make significant change. And in terms of that girl, fundamentally changing her life. And indeed, last Friday, you will recall the Prime Minister was in town to launch an app, a mobile app, that would help our homeless find shelter and additional support in the city. And those things would never have happened except for the sheer accident of us having interviewed Mouse a couple of days before he was murdered. One of the key social issues at the moment, as you will all well know, is of course is same-sex marriage, and it's certainly having a great division for the coalition. I actually think the issue's over. It's purely a question of when Parliament will actually change the Marriage Act. I think as far as the generalist community is concerned, the vast majority have accepted that change. It will make no difference to their own lives, and it will occur. To me, one of the most significant social issues that is now confronting us will be the millions of Australians who now and into the future will want to have control over the way they die. Call it rational suicide, call it the right to die, call it what you wish. Our ageing population, living longer and better educated and more bolshy about their medical treatment than previous generations, will make this a key debate in parliaments around the country. The age is a strong supporter of the right to die, with clear legal boundaries. And you will have seen over the past couple of years a number of stories precisely about that issue, telling stories of people who've made that decision themselves and how they may or may not have gone about it. A couple of weeks ago, our health reporter, Julia Medew, did a superb piece on an elderly couple in their 70s, I shouldn't say elderly, a couple in their 70s, neither of whom were suffering a terminal illness, but who decided that they wished to kill themselves in a suicide pact, in effect. Now, normally at best, if the Age ran that story in the paper and online, we might get a couple of 100,000 people who would read it, perhaps 500,000 if we were lucky. Across the first weekend of that story's publication, particularly online, called The Big Sleep, that interactive reached more than 1.3 million people around the world through Facebook alone. We've estimated in that first week that that one story has been read by over 1 million Australians. It's not a news story. Nothing significant to the whole world happened. A couple decided to take their life. Two lovely people who decided to die in peace and at a time of their choosing. And yet, those sort of stories that speak to our community and speak to our own futures and our own lives are the ones that, in fact, can be far more powerful and of greater interest than the car that flips on the Monash Freeway and stops the traffic for one day. News to me then is what matters to you and your family, and I'm sure you're going to talk to me pretty soon about what matters to you in terms of the Age's news coverage. The challenge for any media organisation such as The Age is to use its resources, and our resources are diminishing. It's been my sad task, I have to say, since I took over as editor-in-chief of The Age 3.5 years ago, to farewell around 40% of our newsroom because we are a contracting business. The challenge to us is to focus on the things that matter to many people. for our newsroom to survive, to take on stories like the local mafia, or 7-Eleven underpaying vulnerable people, or institutions that hid sex abusers of children within their ranks, then I do need, as a commercial business, to grab the attention of as many people as I can. That is part of my job. And within those selections, of course, will lie a whole range of judgments, perspectives, debates, and dispute, which I'm very pleased to say is a fundamental core part of the Western democracy in which we live. Thank you very much.